Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Here we are, another week of action to push the PRO Act in America, helping children out of poverty. And today on the show, the Tennessee Labor Council and Local 338, the retail and warehouse workers in New York. Welcome to the Monday, July 19th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on five platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, as well as Pandora. And when you get an opportunity, just take a minute and do this. More and more people are doing it, so we certainly do appreciate it. Just receive our shows on a regular basis. Sign up and do that. Give us a rating. And, of course, we'd appreciate the best rating possible, which would be five stars. Billy Dykus is going to be our first guest on the show today. Billy is a proud United Steelworker member for over 20 years after graduating from the Training and Technology Complex. This was in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. It was called Y-12. He spent 16 years working as a contractor in the field of non-destructive testing in the nuclear, fossil fuel, and paper industries. Billy is a member of two steelworkers local, 7509, which represents workers at the Eaton Corporation, and 1155L, Bridgestone-Firestone. You may recall the steelworkers merged with the rubber workers back in 95. Billy served two terms as vice president of Local 1155L before being reelected and eventually president April of 2015. And since October of 2015, he has served as president of the Tennessee AFL-CIO Labor Council, which is located in Nashville, Tennessee. Website is tnaflcio.org. And that's primarily what he's going to talk about. Not what you call a union-friendly state. We're going to get into that. Here's the crazy thing. By a vote of 67 to 24 to 1, the Tennessee House, this is just a couple of months ago, passed a resolution which would enshrine right to work in the state's constitution. This is going to go before voters in November of 2022. Enshrine it in the Constitution. Can you believe that? We're going to get into that. We're also going to talk about unemployment issues. We'll talk about the work situation and how much work is going to organize labor. But Billy is a fighter, no doubt about that. He'll talk about his background and talk about the future of labor in Tennessee. Nikki Kateman will be joining us later in the show. Nikki comes to us from Local 338 out of Garden City, New York, which is in the Long Island area. This is a local that's been around for 90 years, representing grocery workers, pharmacy workers, transportation, healthcare. Very diverse union. And right now, they represent 600 cannabis workers in New York State, or 70% of the industry. That's pretty good union density, don't you think? Well, it took a while to get there. Local 338 has been actively engaged in cannabis policy since 2013, and they fought for the passage of the Compassionate Care Act, and that happened in 2014. This legislation created New York's medical cannabis program and also included requirements for labor peace to ensure a pathway to unionization for the industry's workers. Now, the local, again, this is 338. Website is 338, local338.org. They were also heavily engaged advocating the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act, speaking from the perspective of ensuring equity for the new industry's workforce, including a requirement and the need for workforce development provisions. 2 years ago, New York State passed the Farm Labor's Fair Labor Practices Act, which grants agricultural and farm workers the right to collectively bargain, and they've been working in partnership with UFCW locals and community organizations to organize farm workers across the state of New York. Sounds like a pretty darn active union. Again, Local 338. 1-800-938-3838.org. That's the website. Nikki Kateman will be joining us as our second guest on the show. While we're talking about cannabis, I have an interesting story to share with you. The San Francisco Labor Council made clear the need to pass the PRO Act when Jordan Billups was fired for trying to form a union. Billups, a bud tender at a cannabis dispensary, I like that, a bud tender, is being reinstated by order of the National Labor Relations Board after being fired illegally for union activity. Beginning in the fall of 2020, workers at the dispensary began to organize a union with the UFCW. This was Local 5. Joe was a leader in the effort to organize a union. Well, after recognizing workers were organizing, the management began to run an anti-union campaign. This was in January of this year, despite federal protections guaranteed under the National Labor Relations Act and local mandates guaranteeing labor peace. So what did they do? They fired them. This situation also makes clear that we need to pass the PRO Act, Protect the Right to Organize. Under current law, the penalties against employers who illegally fire or retaliate against workers who are trying to form a union are a drop in the bucket. You're in labor, you know about this. As a result, employers routinely retaliate against pro-union workers because they know it will undermine the organizing campaign, and they face hardly any consequences. Speaking of which, we are in the midst of a pro week of action. It actually started on Saturday. The AFL-CIO and their allies are engaging in a nationwide pro act week of action with a focus on in-person rallies at state offices at all 100 U.S. senators, every one of them. You want to get some more information, just go to aflcio.org. And this is going to go until July 25th, which is what, this weekend? Yeah, Sunday. Last Thursday, Americans began to see the concrete effects of the American Rescue Plan show up in their bank accounts as the expanded child tax credit went into effect for 1 year. Through this program, the child tax credit increased to $3,000 per child if the child is aged between 6 and 17, and $3,600 per child under 6. Now, all working families will get the full credit if they make up to $150,000 for a couple or $112,500 for a family with a single parent. The government sent payments for almost 60 million children last Thursday, totaling $15 billion. It's amazing, isn't it? This is, again, part of the American Rescue Plan. And it's a big deal. Why? Because 1 in 7 children lives in poverty. That's right. And they figure this measure is expected to cut that poverty nearly in half. Nearly in half. And mind you, not one Republican, not one, voted for the American Rescue Plan. Not one. Hats off to AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Secretary Treasurer Elisa McBride said the credit will provide a vital lifeline so families can rebuild their financial security, and it will reduce poverty nationwide. I mean, everybody's talking about that right now. So what they did on their website, they have a calculator. You might want to check this out. Just go to AFSCME.org, and you can calculate what states are going to get the biggest windfall on this. Again, this is all part of the American Rescue Plan. And there's another website you might want to check out, childtaxcredit.gov. That's the government's website, childtaxcredit.gov. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Billy Dykus on behalf of the Tennessee AFL-CIO is coming up next.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at UAW.org.
The Heat and Frost Insulators and Allied Workers are proud to be a title sponsor for America's Workforce Radio. The Insulators Union is leading the way in the mechanical insulation industry, fire stopping, and infectious disease control. Regarded as North America's energy conservation specialist, these professionals are known for their professional work and dedication. You can learn more about the Insulators Union at insulators.org.
Union members need to be heard. Reliable and convenient union voting has never been more important than it is now. Make voting easy for your membership by working with survey and ballot systems. SBS offers encrypted and monitored solutions that ensure your elections are accurate and accessible for every member through mail-in, online, and in-person voting. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com and take the next step in getting secure and auditable elections.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle is at AWF Union Podcast, AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment on the show is brought to you by the fine folks at the North Coast Area Labor Federation, all connected to the AFL-CIO. Let's go to our live line and join a newcomer. His name is Billy Dykus. Billy is a proud United Steelworker, member for over 20 years. He's also, since October of 2015, the president of the Tennessee AFL-CIO Labor Council, which is located in Nashville, Tennessee. And that's where he's talking to us from today. TNAFLCIO.org is their website, and we got a lot to talk about. This is a series of check-ins, I guess that's the best way to put it, on various labor councils around the country to see the labor climate. And being a right-to-work state, this is a tough one. Hey, Billy Dykus, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Talk to me a little bit about your background. I mentioned you're a steel worker. Is that from your family members, your dad? How did you get involved in the steel industry? Let's start right there.
Well, it's my father was actually a pastor and worked in a pencil mill all his life. So my labor union history started when I moved to Detroit as a young man in 1978. Working construction at an Enrico Fermi nuclear power plant. So my labor background began by working in the construction trades and then specializing in erosion, corrosion on piping systems, and then moving into an environment where I went to work with the steel workers at Eaton Corporation, actually machining transmission parts for tractor-trailer trucks. And then the plant closed, actually, and I, of all things, I went to work at Bridgestone Firestone as a rubber worker, and then we merged with the steelworkers again. I always said the steelworkers were always looking for somebody to keep them on the road, and that's why they merged with the rubber workers. I don't know that I'm not quite sure that the powers to be thought that was the right way to put it, but that's what I used to tell them. Found that the steelworker family is quite huge, and it's been a real blessing to be a member of the steelworkers and what they've brought to the table for the working people.
It's interesting because, you know, we record the show in Cleveland, Ohio, actually in Ironworkers Hall, Local 17, and you've got a lot of remote ties to this area because Eaton Corporation, I know, is headquartered in Cleveland, and that was Steelworkers Local 7509. Yep. And then with Bridgestone Firestone, that's the Akron area, and that's Local 1155L. So interesting history here. How'd you find your way to Nashville? Talk to me about that part.
Well, I was always active in the union because I always felt that that was my responsibility as a union member. So it doesn't take long to become a shop steward. If you're vocal and you're involved. So I became a shop steward at Bridgestone Firestone, and that led to a vice presidency and then three terms as a president of the local union. And I was fortunate enough that the people here in the state of Tennessee and felt that I was the person to lead the Tennessee AFL-CIO going forward, and they actually recruited me, which was a strange circumstance. I had some folks come to me and say, hey, we think you're the guy. And mm-hmm. as a, and I've always been real talkative, which I get that from my father, the pastor part of my family.
Right.
So I didn't really expect it, but it's been a true blessing to be able to take the time and efforts out to be around the people. And one of the things that I think that kind of swayed their opinion was I was of the opinion that, you know, we live in a technological world, and it's such a great thing to be able to pick up your phone and text and, you know, do Twitter and email and, you know, all the different things. But I still believe that one of the things the labor movement misses on sometime is we kind of lost that connection of, you know, just going around and shaking hands and patting people on the back and saying, hey, I know it's tough out there, but you've done a good job today. And that's something that I've tried to do since I've been in this job is to take time to go out and be around the members and explain to them that there's somebody there fighting for them while they're out there on their day-to-day jobs.
You have a tough state, my friend. When I talk to somebody from Tennessee, I think back to the UAW drive in Chattanooga back in 2014 where the Volkswagen folks wanted the union. Now, that doesn't happen too often. They want the union, and the politicians there said, no, it's not going to happen, and it didn't happen. It was a slim loss, though. I think it was under 90 votes or something, and then I think they're trying to organize at Nissan over there as well. That's with the machinists. But that being said, what's the current labor climate in Tennessee? Is it still pretty much the same, and how are you navigating it?
Well, it's very difficult, of course, in the state of Tennessee to run an organizing campaign when, you know, especially the legislature is a supermajority of the Republican Party, and they wield immense power, and they're willing, you mentioned the Chattanooga organizing campaign. Well, you know, the state of Tennessee put almost $1 billion into that facility, and there was a commitment to put $550 million of that part of that $1 billion that was put in there that they were willing to withdraw if they voted the union in there. So there was immense pressure on the people, and that's the kind of things that we deal with. And you know, the other side is being a part of the Bible Belt sometimes is. It's difficult to get folks to understand that working people are working people, and all those things that they tend to bring to the forefront that even our members focus on are not the things that are going to move anybody forward, much less working people. And so it's a difficult environment, to say the least. And you know, I think that you know, the good and the bad of being here is, you know, we're a right-to-work state, but almost all the labor unions here are pretty close to 90% or more unionized. The members want to be in the union. So we're small in numbers, but there's a lot of strength amongst those small numbers, which does make it a little easier to navigate the political process and some of the issues we have.
Now, I know Nashville is a booming city, booming. A lot of people moving there each and every day, a lot of construction. Let me ask you this. That construction, and we get a lot of the trades on the show, and they're looking for workers. I'm just wondering, are we seeing a good union density in construction in the trades there? What do we know about that right now, Billy?
Well, it's funny you asked that question. I just took two young gentlemen from my hometown over to the IBEW today and signed them up in the apprenticeship program.
Good for you.
It's booming, but much like a lot of the other southern states and the booming cities in the South, they've made it difficult for a lot of our union contractors. Now, look, we've got all the work we can handle in the building trades right now. There's actually a Facebook job that's going on in Gallatin, Tennessee, that an apprentice in the IBEW can go to work at, and by the time he leaves that job, he'll be a journeyman electrician. So it's not that we're having a hard time with union labor or union jobs. The problem is that they've got the system structured here where there's a prime contractor, and then there's a sub to the sub to the sub, and a lot of the work that's going on, especially in downtown Nashville, is being subbed out to, I call it, third party contractors, and they're notorious for hiring day labor, you know, showing up and hiring people and bringing them on, and so that's been the real challenge around our building trades is trying to find ways to circumvent that. The problem is we did a local hire in Nashville. The people voted on it in the county, and then the state legislature came in and passed the law outlawing local hire.
I'm not surprised. I don't mean to laugh, but I've seen this all across the board where municipalities would raise the minimum wage, and then the legislature and the state would say, no, you can't do that. No, yeah. Not going to happen. Yeah. I mean, I could go on and on and on. Let's talk, if you don't mind, about unemployment issues. And I understand. Well, here's another example. Federal government gives you money, the $300 in the American Rescue Plan. And then you got states, and it happened in the state of Ohio. It happened, I think, in half the country, about 26 states, where the governor said, hey, you know what? There's too many lazy people out there. There's work that needs to be done. They're sitting on their butt collecting unemployment benefits. And I guess the same thing happened in Tennessee. Is that right?
That's correct. Our famous governor that likes to say he's just a good old country boy, he felt like that the people of Tennessee have become too lazy to accept the jobs that are out there on the website that they force you to go to when you draw unemployment. So he felt like if he cut out that extra $300 they were going to get for, what, another couple of months until the 1st of September, that maybe he could force those people to take a job. The bad part of it is, of the 247,000 jobs they claim are there, only 3% of them pay above poverty. So you can kind of see why a person it's not like they're getting rich anyway. The unemployment benefit here is only $275 a week. You're barely going to buy groceries with that. So that's their wisdom. That was their thought process. And I don't know if you also know they went about cutting unemployment benefits from 26 weeks to 12 in this last legislative cycle. Now you can get up to 20 weeks. But the unemployment has to be 9% or higher. But in order to get 20 weeks, they actually index it. At 5.5%, you draw 12 weeks unemployment. And then for every 0.5% up to 9%, you get an additional week. And that's based on statewide unemployment rates. And one of the things we tried to get them to understand was, you know, you mentioned Nashville. Well, Knoxville, Chattanooga, and Memphis are also booming. But what about those folks in them rural areas where, you know, the hospitals, and I think we lead the country in hospital closures. Hospitals are closing. Then that is the main source of employment other than Walmart. And the unemployment rates in those counties is 19% and 20%. So how do you justify that to a person that's out there that, you know, would like to go to work? But he's an hour and a half or 2 hours from Nashville, and he'd have to leave his hometown, or he's only going to get 12 weeks unemployment. The system is messed up anyway. It's hard to get draw unemployment benefits. The computer system has been revamped twice. I'm on the Unemployment Advisory Council. It's been revamped twice in the last 6 years. I don't know how many millions of dollars has been spent to try to make it more user-friendly. And now they've added the caveat of indexing and 5.5%. I see it becoming more and more of an issue for people to actually be able to, when they get unemployed, to actually draw unemployment. And I think that's as much by design as it anything. But, you know, people are not lazy. They're not wanting to sit home, but you can't expect people to take a job that pays less than poverty level wages and to try to raise kids and a family on, or even themselves, and pay insurance and afford a home. It's as some folks would say, ass backwards.
I know child care has jumped ridiculously since the pandemic. I'm here in some cases, some parts of America, double. And you think about all the...
I've been fortunate and unfortunate, maybe is the right way to say it. I have two grandchildren that live with me now.
Uh-huh.
And my youngest grandson, he's not in daycare now, but he was prior to this year. And, you know, on the cheap side, $120 to $150 a week, and that's whether they go or not. And you know, and I'm fortunate enough that I can afford that. I don't know how anyone, even making $15 an hour, can afford that kind of money and raise a family. And I couldn't imagine what it's like right now. I like I said, I'm fortunate that he's not in daycare now, but I don't know how people afford it. It's another one of those reasons that cutting off that $300 is so backwards.
Exactly.
You know, Bill Lee's got his own company out here that he likes to say is one of the best in the country. He don't have to worry about child care. I'm sure his wife is able to stay home and take care of her children, his and her children. But the average person that's out there that has either lost his job, especially, you know, it's amazing how many restaurants are closed.
Still.
Not back up and operating. Those folks are out there waiting to go to work. But if you can't pay them enough to take care of their kids, they've got to make a choice.
Exactly. And that's happening all around the country right now. Billy, I got to take a quick break here. Billy Dykus joining us on our live line. He is president of the Tennessee AFL-CIO Labor Council. And in the next segment, we're going to talk about right to work, but not just right to work. They want right to work enshrined in the state constitution. That discussion next right here on America's Workforce.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.
Mesothelioma is a rare type of cancer caused by exposure to asbestos. If you were exposed to asbestos and have mesothelioma or lung cancer, the trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at kellyandferraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
Hire union musicians. Call Music Talent of Cleveland at 216-881-1802. Call Music Talent of Cleveland as your dependable source for professional musicians in Northeast Ohio. Union musicians add harmony to weddings, elegance to parties, and uplifting music for all events. Music Talent of Cleveland contracts solo and ensemble musicians as well as bands and orchestras for single engagements. So hire union musicians. Call Music Talent of Cleveland today. 216-881-1802.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, we're available on 5 platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, as well as Pandora. Let's go back to our live line. Rejoin Billy Dykus. Billy is president of the Tennessee AFL-CIO Labor Council. And we're talking about the anti-union climate down there. Anti-union governor, Bill Lee. And the legislature, I know you got a super majority here, so it looks like you're kind of stuck in the mud here for a couple of years. But I'm just wondering about right to work. Now, you've been a right to work state for quite some time. And what is this now? They want to enshrine this in your state constitution?
It's been pushed by Brian Kelsey that, you know, he was one of the lead lawyers in the Janus case. He happens to be one of our state senators. And the Liberty Justice Center and Americans for Prosperity, the Chamber of Commerce, and the National Federation of Independent Businesses have decided that by putting this in the Constitution, it guarantees that it'll never be changed without at least two-thirds majority of the votes and then another vote of the people, which really is truly kind of crazy when you think it's been here since 1947. It's not going to change anything other than making it harder to ever have a conversation about right to work and what it really means. I actually call the constitutional amendment, it's not only going to enshrine right to work, but it's going to enshrine at-will employment, guarantee at-will employment stays that way in the state of Tennessee. And that's the difficult part of being in this state is, you know, the person that coined right to work was way, way far ahead of his time because when you mention it to people and you say, well, what do you know about right to work? Well, everybody's got a right to work. I said, well, that's not my point. Yeah, everybody's got a right to work, but do you understand that it means that you got a right to belong to a labor union? Not don't give you any rights in particular other than what the protected rights are, you know. And they said, well, what do you mean by that? And I said, well, do you belong to a labor union? No. I said, do you have a contract in your workplace of any kind with your employer? No. I said, well, you're an at-will employee. And they go, what's that mean? That means that your employer can walk in at any time and say, you no longer, your service is no longer needed. He don't have to tell you why. They go, well, that's not right. I said, well, that's what right to work really means. It empowers yep. your employer to be able to say you're no longer needed, and he don't have to tell you why. And that's, you know, some of the feedback we get from the employers is, well, they got a right to leave anytime they want. Well, that's true. They do. But they, to use right to work as a avenue to continue to use to put it, it's a low wage state. They advertise that the state of Tennessee advertises it's right to work. We have low wages and cheap labor, and they sell the people of Tennessee short. I testified before the state senate, and that's one of the things I told them that we really should be ashamed of ourselves as representatives of the state of Tennessee to go out and talk to people outside the state and say our people are basically cheap. You can buy us cheap. We really should be talking about education and how hard people in Tennessee work, but that's lost on them, and they won't enshrine it in the Constitution so that it can stay that way.
Billy, let me ask you this. You're aware of the PRO Act, the Protect the Right to Organize Act, and I know we still need some votes on that on the Democratic side, but it's my understanding when that passes, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed on this one, when that passes, right to work is gone across the country. Now, if they get their way and it's enshrined in the Constitution, is that still the case to your knowledge?
The way I understand it is that if the PRO Act passes, then that will it will not be a part of the Constitution because the national legislation will override the state legislation. And during the testimony, this past legislative cycle, that was one of the big pitching points was the PRO Act, the PRO Act. Yeah. And Virginia was brought up quite frequently about some of the activities that's going on in Virginia. But the PRO Act was mentioned numerous, numerous times about how it's going to take away the rights of the employers and it's going to not benefit the working people, and they won't have a choice any longer. And you know, that's a lot of the parts that's really difficult to explain is even if you're not in a right-to-work state, you don't have to belong to the union. The difference is in a right-to-work state, you don't have to pay union dues. And in non-right-to-work states, you got to pay fair share. You're not just going to be there and say, I'm not paying dues and I'm going to get all the benefits. And that's, you know, that they understand very well that by keeping the unions in a position where they can maneuver the news cycle, that they can keep us, they can make us weaker, and they understand that, and they use that to try to keep us down, and they've done a good job of it. They've done a real good job of it.
Yeah, they're trying to bankrupt the unions. You get the representation of the union, but you don't have to pay any dues. I mean, it would be like going to a country club and using the facilities of that country club and say, you know what, I'm not going to pay for it. Now, how often does that happen, right?
Could you imagine me walking on the Masters golf course down in Augusta and saying, hey, guys, I think I'm going to play me a round of golf. And by the way, I ain't paying. I'm just going to go out here and hack up your greens and walk all over your fairways, and there ain't nothing you can do about it. Well, I wouldn't last very long because I probably would never get out of jail in Georgia.
No, you wouldn't. Hey, one more question here before you go. Voter suppression laws, and we're seeing them pop up ever since Trump lost the election here because he said the election was rigged. What's the status in Tennessee? Did you go the same route down there?
Well, we already had a majority of what most of all the other states. They have been implementing them across the state for the last probably two or three election cycles. They cut polling places, especially at our at one of our traditionally black universities here, Tennessee State. There used to be some polling places there. They cut those out. They reduced them. And I don't know if this number is accurate, but I think AJ said we went from like 24 or 30 in certain areas to like 8. So we've already seen a lot of those things that have gone that are going on. They're piling on all at once. We've seen that a little at a time throughout the state of Tennessee already.
Very sad. Billy, you're a great guest. Thank you so much. I feel bad that you're going through all of this, but it sounds like you're keeping your head high. You got good people around you. You got the Tennessee AFL-CIO Labor Council. I know it's a struggle, but hopefully better times ahead. At least we got a pro-union guy in the White House. That's right.
And look, yeah. And you know, sometimes you get led down certain paths, and maybe this is just my day to take that path. And look, it ain't like the first time I ain't had my backside kicked, and I ain't beyond kicking backsides either. So we'll see how that works out for them.
There you go, brother. Great attitude. Billy, you take care. Let's keep
really
in touch, okay?
I really appreciate it, and I'm more than happy to get on any time and talk about issues. I'll try not to bore those folks up north with my southern twang. But I used to tell people when I lived in Michigan that I was from the Bronx, the South Bronx, and they used to look at me kind of funny. But it's pretty obvious I'm not from the South Bronx. But I've been to Cleveland a few times and been to Put-in Bay. I love it. Probably too old to go there now, but what a great place to be. I love Cleveland.
It is. Yeah, there's some good sites around here, no doubt about it. Plus, we're the home of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum. So
that's right.
All right, my friend. Take care, be safe, and we'll be in touch, I promise, all right?
Hey, thank you.
Always enjoy checking in with labor councils around America to see what's happening in various states. And there's the Tennessee Labor Council. You can find more at tnaflcio.org. And again, thank you, Billy Dykus. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Nikki Kateman, on behalf of the retail warehouse workers out of New York, Local 338. She's coming up next.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as health care and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy,
and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
Have you or a loved one been diagnosed with prostate, breast, or any other cancer after taking Zantac? You may be entitled to compensation. The trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at kellyandferraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle is at AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the fine folks at the Ohio Federation of Teachers. Their website, oh.aft.org. Melissa Cropper will be joining us tomorrow, and I'm sure she's got a lot to talk about. Let's go to line number two. Nikki Kateman is joining us on our live line from Garden City, New York, which is in the Long Island area. And Nikki is the political and communications director for local 338 on behalf of the Retail Warehouse Union, affiliated also with the Food and Commercial Workers Union. 13,000 members, and that's keeping Nikki very, very busy. Hey, Nikki, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here with you.
You have an interesting story. We were talking off the air about how Nikki got involved with the union. And I love hearing that because we a lot of times as well, my dad, my mother, sometimes it was something happened at work. I had to do something. I had to organize a union. Talk to me about your story, Nikki. Go ahead.
Sure. So my dad was a member of Local 338 for pretty much most of my life. He worked at a local grocery store. When I was a senior in high school, I applied for the union scholarship program, which in a bittersweet twist, I'm now in part responsible for administering. So I won the scholarship, and the following summer, the union opened internship opportunities to former scholarship winners. I applied, got a spot, started, you know, when I was about 18 years old, worked in the organizing department, and at the time I was going to school for political science, and they brought me over to the political and special projects department, and I have been there ever since. So what started as a scholarship opportunity / internship opportunity became a career and a lifetime passion.
That's awesome. Well, congratulations to you. And
Thank you. Sounds
like you're really engaged in the local. Again, the website is local338.org. Now, you're telling me you represent members all around New York State, but mostly in the New York City, Long Island area. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. We're talking grocery, pharmacy, transportation. Now, I have to ask you, how's everybody doing? Because as you know, you're talking frontline workers here who work through the pandemic, and we're still in the pandemic. And I don't know what, now we got this Delta variant. I don't know the situation in that area. Maybe you could bring us up to speed. How's everybody doing in the local right now, health-wise?
Health-wise, everyone's doing really well. I think it's an interesting time right now. You know, if we were talking this time last year, I think the conversation would be very, very different, right? So I think we're cautious and we're monitoring what's happening because cases are on the rise again. Obviously, nowhere near where it was this time last year, but they are on the rise. We worked really hard to make sure our members who, as you mentioned, are frontline, we're almost an entirely frontline worker union, from everyone from food retail to pharmaceutical retail to healthcare. We also represent nonprofits that provide some social and community services. So we worked really hard to make sure that as soon as our members were eligible for vaccines, that they took advantage of those opportunities. Obviously, you know, that's something I think everybody in the labor movement's working through, is how we continue to encourage and make sure our folks are getting vaccinated. So we're very fortunate. We do monitor how many cases we're getting reported to us each week. We're almost pretty much at the zero mark right now, which is fantastic. But I think, you know, time will tell what's going to happen over the next few months, but also long term, because we did have, you know, much like other unions that represent frontline workers, we did have a number of members who contracted COVID, are still dealing with the long term implications. But at this present moment, I think, you know, it's safe to say that people are are doing pretty well and hanging in there as best as they can. You know, I think there's been a shift to try and remove some of those social distancing protocols and start taking down some of those plexiglasses that you're seeing at supermarkets. But obviously, we are very opposed to that and just want to make sure we're being overly cautious and continue to monitor what's how things are going.
Safety first. I always talk about that on the show. Safety first. It's so important. Organizing. We have seen pockets of organizing as a result of the pandemic. You think about the non-union grocery stores. There's a good example right there. I remember seeing some stories about like Trader Joe's. Did you see that? Do you see some organizing opportunities in the last year, year and a half because of the pandemic?
We had some calls from folks who reached out. If you can believe it, we actually had a number of managers reaching out who were frustrated by what was happening in their stores, that coming down from the corporate level. We did have some organizing opportunities. Quite honestly, they were in the childcare center sector, which is really exciting. But I think it's really the pandemic has, to your point, really cast a spotlight on the union difference. And we've seen, it's been very sexy to be essential worker. And when doing some of the media coverage over the last year, reporters have been really on top of highlighting the union versus non-union difference, which has really, I think, helped opportunities for us, but also for other unions who are organizing in the various essential and frontline sectors.
I use that line a lot, the union difference, and it is a huge difference when it comes to the non-union sector in American employment today. Well, one sector that you have been very, very successful in is organizing cannabis workers. And I was reading this earlier on the show, and I'm reading that your local represents 600 cannabis workers in New York State, or approximately 70% of the industry. Now, this didn't happen overnight. Nikki, talk to me about how you were able to achieve this.
So this is a long process, as you mentioned, and quite frankly started with our international union, the UFCW, which represents cannabis workers across the country. So we got involved in New York State with advocating for the passage of the Compassionate Care Act, which created New York's medical cannabis program in about 2012. And we worked really closely with patient advocates, caregivers, veterans groups, a number of different organizations who are really advocating for the legalization of medical cannabis for, plenty of reasons and the palliative difference it makes for those who are chronically ill. And one of the things we fought for in the passage of the bill, which was successful in 2014, was a labor peace agreement, a requirement, which was a condition of licensure and ongoing requirement of it. And that has really been helped us to be successful in organizing the industry, and we're really proud of that. So in the time since the passage of the Compassionate Care Act, as you mentioned, we've organized about 600 workers, and we represent folks who are cultivating, processing, manufacturing, distributing, and retailing cannabis, so across the entire supply chain. And we've continued to work in this space and be a voice in advocating for continued cannabis policy. And we were part of the coalition that fought for the passage of the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act, which finally passed this year in New York State. And we're incredibly proud of that work because it's going to bring so many new opportunities. And the main focus of the passage of the MRTA, as it should have been, was around equity and ensuring access for opportunities for communities that have long been harmed by drug enforcement policies. And part of that conversation was really focused not just on entrepreneurial and ownership opportunities, but ensuring that the workforce really is also able to have access to quality union jobs that they are also able to provide for their families, give back to their communities, because we recognize not everyone's going to be able to own a cannabis business. And frankly, not everybody wants to own a cannabis business. They just, happy working in the space. And part of this also conversation is focused on how do we also ensure that there's workforce development? Because there's going to be thousands of new jobs in this space. It's a brand new industry. recognizing there are people working in the underground economy now, but there are plenty of folks who are going to be excited to participate in what's going to be an emerging industry with, you know, different jobs directly in the industry, but also, quite frankly, indirectly in the industry through ancillary businesses and, quite frankly, opportunities for our brothers and sisters in the building and construction trades who are going to be building out these facilities. So we are incredibly proud of the work we've done in the cannabis space, both in terms of ensuring that it's an industry with equity and opportunity, but also directly in the industry. We really believe that we have built a gold standard for what cannabis careers can look like. We want to make sure that these are long-term jobs that people are able to start at a company and spend their entire career there and grow up the career ladder. And so, you know, our folks have access to all the things we fight so hard for, you know, good wages, good benefits, job protection, and opportunities to grow in their company that they work for.
You talked about the growth. I wonder if we could get into that a little deeper.
Sure.
You said like thousands of jobs. Do we have projections on that? I would imagine. I mean, this industry's it has been growing by leaps and bounds. And it depends what part of America. Obviously, in New York,
right.
it's been very labor friendly. Do you have any idea? What do you see in, you know, 5-10 years for this industry, Nikki?
So I think it's in New York. You know, I can speak to New York much better, obviously, because that's my home state. But there have been estimates
sure.
that there could be 30 to 60,000 jobs directly within the industry. Obviously, that number is exponentially larger when you talk about all the ancillary businesses, right? And when you talk about ancillary business, it's everything from, you know, the you know, building trades and construction folks. We're talking about accounting. We're talking about, you know, marketing companies that pop up. But we're also talking about you know, other sort of things, right? The, you know, folks who are supplying equipment for these facilities, right? So there's, you know, potential for, you know, the baseline, you know, I think is that number that we've seen used is 30 to 60,000 jobs. But that number could be exponentially larger for folks that are kind of on the, you know, maybe not directly doing plant touching jobs, but are doing things that support that growing and emerging industry, right? I think it's also a little bit hard to say what can happen because there are some regulatory things that we have to see what happens in New York State. That process is still unfolding. But I think there could be, you know, the really fascinating thing about cannabis is there's constant research and development happening. So, you know, there are potentially jobs that we don't even know exist yet in 5 to 10 years because of how the industry could change the science behind it, how that can develop. But also recognizing that, you know, there could be federal legalization at some point, and that could also really change how many jobs there are if, you know, right now you can't cross state lines. But we're really excited about the potential in New York. You know, it's, you know, the medical program has, you know, there's about 1,000 jobs in New York State. Obviously, we expect that to grow under the passage of the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act. They did provide for some provisions to make it easier for patients to access the program. And we think that'll be, you know, also a job growth opportunity as well. But I think it's safe guess is tens of thousands of jobs over the next 5 to 5 years, and then 10 years from now, I think it's, you know, the future is really unlimited in this industry, particularly as the stigma continues to dwindle around it.
I love it. I'd like to see it grow. And obviously when it grows, the union members grow.
Yes.
So it's good stuff.
Absolutely.
Nikki, great job. I tell you, I'm so glad you took that internship. You're an awesome guest on the show.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And you know what?
I spend a lot of time thinking about cannabis, so always happy to talk about it.
I want to invite you back because I'm reading you've done a pretty good job organizing winery workers. Well, actually, farm workers that work at a winery on Long Island. That's another story, but we're just about out of time. I just want to give the website out. It's a local338.org, and you could also follow the local on Twitter at local338. Nikki, take care, keep in touch, and stay safe, okay?
Absolutely. You too. Thank you again for having me.
All right, that's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up tomorrow, the latest from the Ohio Federation of Teachers and connecting unions with contractors. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.